listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2015 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud. So tonight's two great authors, Adam Johnson and Blaine Harden, will be in a program titled Unveiling North Korea with Fact and Fiction, which I think fits in with our theme from our last program about Ukraine with Timothy Snyder and Masha Gessen, talking about fact and fiction. Tonight, how do you tell the story of a place where state-sponsored storytelling reigns supreme? Quote, in North Korea, I think the people know everything they are being told is a lie, but they have no idea what the truth may be, Adam Johnson remarked in an interview about his remarkable novel, The Orphan Master's Son. Johnson's novel traces the journey of the unforgettable Jun Do, who for years lives under the violent dictates of the state as a tunnel expert who can fight in the dark, a kidnapper, a radio operator, a tenuous hero, and a foreign dignitary before he eventually takes his fate into his own hands. Where we are from, one of the novel's characters says, stories are factual. If a farmer is declared a music virtuoso by the state, everyone had better start calling him maestro. And secretly, he'd be wise to start practicing the piano. For us, the story is more important than the person. If a man and his story are in conflict, it is the man who must change. Johnson, who trained as a journalist before he began writing novels, teaches creative writing at Stanford. He's been awarded many prizes and fellowships, including a Whiting Writers Award and a Guggenheim. The Orphan Master's Son received the 2013 Pulitzer in Fiction and is the author of several short story collections and the novel Parasites Like Us. His books have been translated into 23 languages. Blaine Harden has also had a long, distinguished career as a journalist and author. He is the author of Africa, Dispatches from a Fragile Continent, A River Lost, The Life and Death of the Columbia, and Escape from Camp 14, One Man's Remarkable Odyssey from North Korea to Freedom in the West, which was an international bestseller published in 27 languages. He served as bureau chief in East Asia, Eastern Europe, and Africa for the Washington Post, and among his many awards is the Ernie Pyle Award for coverage of the Siege of Sarajevo during the Bosnian War. And tonight, we celebrate his new book, which is titled The Great Leader and the Fighter Pilot, The True Story of the Tyrant Who Created North Korea and the Young Lieutenant Who Stole His Way to Freedom. I love that long title. It's his second account of North Korea following escape from Camp 14. You'll hear it tonight, what he relied on in terms of his research with declassified documents and interviews. And with this book, he applies his journalistic acumen to the task of tracking two pivotal players at the dawn of the Kim regime as a way of explaining how the monstrous political system of North Korea came into existence in the first place. So tonight we'll hear from both of these authors who offer a unique lens into North Korean history, its politics, and the life of its citizens, more than one. Please welcome Blaine Harden and Adam Johnson. Thank you.
Did these work? Can you hear me?
Are we on?
Okay. Thank you, Russell. Okay. Thanks, Luis, for that wonderful introduction. Blaine, thanks for traveling here tonight. Look at this amazing audience. The place is packed.
It's much better than the other night for me.
Well, it's a great honor to be in Los Angeles. What a literary, serious town for books, you know. I once lived here in a place called North Hollywood. And I went to go find it. I couldn't even find North Hollywood. It's called Valley Village now. And my cute little bungalow surrounded once by porn stars and Armenian mobsters was now on a light rail stop with a big new palace there. So I don't know L.A. anymore. Tonight we're going to talk about writing, about representation of North Korea. Blaine has two books set there, a new one that's just released now. We were asked to maybe read just a sampling. So we were each going to read, I was going to read 2 pages, the opening, and he was going to read a page and a half. And maybe we'd have a conversation and open it up for a question and answer, because people are usually fascinated, and I love people's questions. So that's maybe our format. Has anyone here been to the Democratic People's Republic of Korea?
No one.
Anyone? There's two there. What years did you go? 3 years ago? Last year and the year before, twice. Is anyone here from there? Because LA is a very likely place. I think most big audiences, there's at least one person who's been there. So feel free to, when we talk, share your experiences or observations. Okay, I was going to read just two pages. It won't be long. The book, which is available for sale, which I'd happily sign. I think if you buy two, we'll sign together and pose for a picture. Okay, so I'm sorry, Blaine, I apologize. I just get nervous in front of people. The book I wrote is a novel, and it's set in North Korea. There's a fairly normal character who lives an unnormal, extraordinary life. It doesn't end well, and so part of the book is his story. He is then captured by the state and kind of interrogated, and they try to figure out how this unusual life could have been lived in their country where that shouldn't be possible. So there's the story of the man who extracts the story, and then the story that's extracted is spun into propaganda to, instead of undermine the state, to glorify it. So you get the same story 3 different ways, which sounds narcissistic and repetitive, self-indulgent. But the book opens with just 2 pages of the propaganda voice, which the loudspeakers aren't as common anymore, but there used to be a day when you couldn't get away from them. Citizens, gather around your loudspeakers, for we bring important updates. In your kitchens, in your offices, on your factory floors, wherever your loudspeaker is located, turn up the volume. In local news, our dear leader Kim Jong-il was seen offering on-the-spot guidance to the engineers deepening the Taedong River channel. While the dear leader lectured to the dredge operators, many doves were seen to spontaneously flock above him, hovering to provide our reverend general some much-needed shade on a hot day. Also to report is a request from Pyongyang's Minister of Public Safety, who asks that while pigeon snaring season is in full swing, tripwires and snatch loops be placed out of the reach of our youngest comrades. And don't forget, citizens, the ban on stargazing is still in effect. Later in the broadcast, we'll reveal the winning recipe for this month's cooking contest. Hundreds of recipes were entered, but only one can be declared the best way to prepare pumpkin rind soup. But first comes grave news from the East Sea, where American aggressors flirt with acts of all-out war after stopping and looting a North Korean fishing vessel. Once again, the Yankees have violated Korean waters to steal the precious contents of a sovereign ship, all the while accusing us of everything from banditry to kidnapping to cruelty to sharks. First off, it is the Americans. It is the Americans and their puppets who are the pirates of the sea. Secondly, did an American woman not recently row around the entire world to defect to our great nation, a workers' paradise where citizens want for nothing? That alone should be proof enough that these persistent accusations of kidnapping are ludicrous. But cruelty to sharks. This charge must be addressed. Known as the fisherman's friend, the shark has an ancient camaraderie with the Korean people. In the year 1592, did sharks not offer fish from their own mouths to help sustain Admiral Yi's sailors during the siege of Okpo Harbor? Have sharks not developed cancer-preventing powers in order to help their human friends live longer and healthier? Does our own Commander Ga, winner of the Golden Belt, not have a soothing bowl of shark fin soup before each triumphant Taekwondo match? And citizens, did you not see with your own eyes a movie entitled A True Daughter of the Country, right here in Pyongyang's own Moranbang Theater? Then certainly you remember the scene in which our national actress Sun Moon capsized in Incheon Bay while trying to prevent the American sneak attack. It was a scary moment for all of us as the sharks began to circle her, helpless amid the waves. But did the sharks not recognize Sun Moon's Korean modesty? Did they not smell the hot blood of her patriotism and lift her upon their fins to carry her safely to shore where she could join the raging battle to repel the imperialist invaders? By these deeds alone, citizens, you must know that the rumors swirling around Pyongyang that the Commander Ga and Sun Moon are anything less than utterly in love are baseless lies. Baseless as the boarding of our innocent fishing vessels by foreign powers. Baseless as the outlandish allegations of kidnapping leveled at us by the Japanese. Do the Japanese think we forget it is they who once enslaved our husbands and made comfort women of our wives? Baseless to think that any woman loves her husband more than Sun Moon. Did the citizens not behold how Sun Moon bestowed the golden belt upon her new husband, her cheeks flushed with modesty and love? Were you not assembled in Kim Il-sung Square to witness it firsthand? What are you going to believe, citizens? Rumors and lies or your very own eyes? But let us return to the rest of today's programming, which includes a rebroadcast of Kim Il-sung's glorious speech from April 15th, Juche 71. And a public service announcement from the Minister of Procurement, Comrade Buck, on the topic of prolonging the life of compact fluorescent light bulbs. But first, citizens, a treat. It is our pleasure to announce that Pyongyang has a new opera singer. The dear leader has dubbed her the Lovely Visitor. And here she is to sing for your patriotic pleasure the arias from Sea of Blood. So return to your industrial lays and vinylon looms, citizens, and double your output quotas as you listen to this lovely visitor sing the story of the greatest nation in the world, the Democratic People's Republic of Korea. Okay, thank you.
I have a tip. Never read your book after he reads his book. This book is a book about the Korean War. Most of it is set in the run-up to and during. And the setup for the piece I'm going to read is that Kim Il-sung is running the country, doing the Soviets' bidding in North Korea. And he wants to go to war and unite the Korean Peninsula under Soviet power. But he needs Stalin's permission, and he needs Stalin's guns and tanks. And this is a bit about their conversations and about the way in which he tried to persuade Stalin, sometimes called the boss, to go along. The best measure of how large Stalin loomed in Kim's imagination is slavish imitation. More than any leader of any Soviet satellite state, Kim swallowed Stalinism whole. Like Stalin, he collectivized agriculture, overbuilt heavy industry, created a gulag of political labor camps, murdered political enemies, geographically sorted civilians based on perceived loyalty, required people to obtain papers for international travel and internal travel, and incentivized citizens to spy on one another. Kim also copied Stalin's cult of personality, raising it to a religion of the absurd. He sold himself to the North Korean people as a caring father who also happened to be the smartest, most important individual ever to walk the earth. And like Stalin, Kim apparently had an outsized appetite for comely, compliant, and disposable young women. In March 1949, Kim had his first chance to meet his totalitarian role model when he led a North Korean delegation to Moscow. The visit did not go particularly well, for as much as Kim was eager to flatter Stalin, he was more eager to attack South Korea. "Comrade Stalin," he said, "we believe that the situation makes it necessary and possible to liberate the whole country through military means," Kim said at one meeting. "The reactionary forces of the South will never agree on a peaceful unification and will perpetuate the division of the country until they feel themselves strong enough to attack the North." He told Stalin that it was time to act because North Korea's army was stronger. It would receive the support of powerful guerrilla army in the South, and the people in the South would rise up to help because they hated Americans. Stalin was unconvinced. He told Kim he did not have his facts straight. You should not advance to the south, Stalin said. First of all, the Korean People's Army does not have an overwhelming superiority over the troops of the south. Numerically, as I understand, you are even behind them. More worrying for Stalin were the Americans. Stalin reminded Kim that American troops were still in the south and would bite back if the north attacked. One should not forget that the agreement on the 38th parallel is in effect between the USSR and the United States, Stalin said. Kim pouted. Does this mean that there is no chance to reunify Korea in the near future, he asked. Our people are very anxious to be together again, to cast off the yoke of the reactionary regime and their American masters. By the way, these quotes come from the notes made at the meeting. Stalin, in response, did not slam the door shut on war. He counseled watchful patience. If the South Koreans and the Americans start the aggression, Stalin told Kim, then you will have a good opportunity to launch a counterattack. So Kim went back to Pyongyang. He was watchful, but he wasn't patient. His forces kept skirmishing with the South Koreans. Finally, Kim proposed a limited preemptive strike. And if that blow seemed to demoralize the South Korean army, then Kim's forces would move further south. If not, the North would hold on to a new perimeter and be easier to defend. Kim was so eager to go to war that he would push Stalin into it. When Stalin heard about this plan in a cable, he was furious. He said, "It is impossible to view this operation other than as the beginning of a war." An early draft of a message the Politburo sent Kim that year dismissed Kim and his fever for war. He said that if the North attacked, the Americans will certainly move into South Korea, and you, Kim, cannot stop this. You cannot even defeat the South Korean army. Between Stalin and Kim, a pattern emerged. Kim begged for an invasion. His pleas produced 48 telegrams to the Kremlin. Each time, Stalin slapped Kim down, but not so hard that he did not dare beg again. Then in January 19, 1950, Stalin changed his mind. He said the international situation had tilted in favor of war. And 6 months later, North Korea attacked the South.
I wanted to ask a question just to start off. You know, we were talking over dinner about how, you know, some places are kind of at the edges of the range of human experience, and North Korea seems like one of them. And by looking at, you know, the humanity farther away from our experience, you know, we can ponder our own selves in certain ways. And it's something a little obsessive about North Korea. The more you look, the more interesting it is, and the more you want to know, and the more you think about your own lives. How did you get interested in this topic and down the path?
Well, it was less soulful. My editor told me unless I wrote more about North Korea, he was going to bring me home. I was in Tokyo at the time for the Washington Post, and I was writing cute little feature stories, as I was wont to do for many years, about the Japanese, all kinds of feature stories. And he came to Tokyo, and we had lunch, and he said, "No more of those stories. Tell me something new, something that will grab readers by the throat about North Korea, because we're getting boring stories from this very interesting country." Mm-hmm. And so with that sort of existential threat, I focused on North Korea for the better part of 2 years and wrote 80% of my stories about North Korea. And during the course of that reporting, I met Shin Dong-hyuk, who was a concentration camp survivor, was born in one of the camps and escaped. And he's the subject of my first book, which we'll probably talk about a lot tonight. But after I wrote the story about his life, I really did get deeply, deeply and emotionally involved in the story. In part because to do the reporting, I spent a lot of time with defectors. And it takes a lot of time because they do not tell their stories easily. They're afraid. They're paranoid. All defectors who come to South Korea go to a resettlement center, as you know, Hanawon. And they spend a couple months there, sometimes longer, if they're deeply, deeply disturbed. But the psychologists and psychiatrists who work there and who've interviewed all 28,000 of those who've come to South Korea in the past 15 years, they say it is probably fair to describe each and every individual who comes as clinically paranoid. Mm-hmm. And they say that that paranoia is a useful adaptation to a state where there are 270,000 secret policemen. As you write in your novel, there's a secret policeman in every building, and certainly in every city and every town. People are afraid to talk to their own siblings, their parents, about what they really think. Mm-hmm. And as I heard these stories, I mean, I just wanted to know a couple things. I wanted to know where it came from. Who was Kim Il-sung? Mm-hmm. And why did he invent this place?
Right.
And then why has it lasted so long?
We'll get your answers at the end.
Those two questions are, I mean, I'm still interested in writing more about it now. Mm.
The number one expense of Hanawon, of running that place, I discovered was orthodontia, you know, that these people have never seen dentists. Like, it's just such a world of survival, and they're so concerned with physical survival that they don't even get a chance to think about, you know, what it means to live versus what it is to survive, which is a question that I was endlessly asking. But back to your boss who had this order. I think the North Korea I was exposed to through popular media that I ran across for most of my life was depicted as a place of evil, of craziness, of insanity, or of clownishness. Kind of a place of buffoonery, of Kim Jong-il and his elevator shoes, and it was easy to make fun and mock them. But I think several writers in America started to get interested in this place in a serious way, like Barbara Demick, et cetera, David Hawk. There was something turned where people were like, this is actually an ongoing human tragedy. Do you think there was something in the air for your editor, or did he just want eyes on the page?
Well, one of the things that happened was David Hawk wrote a book in 2002, I believe it was published. Called Hidden Gulag. And he was the first to use the testimony of camp survivors who had started to trickle into South Korea in the late 1990s. And that trickle actually increased to where there are now more than 60 individuals who have lived in the camps and come to South Korea. He used their testimony and correlated it with increasingly precise satellite images. And his book brought both together. And all of a sudden, you had social science mm-hmm. with documentary evidence that these camps were there. And the stories from the camp survivors were all very, very similar. People had come, had lived in the camps in the 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s at that point. And they all were treated exactly the same way. The camps were run very much in the way that Kim Il-sung wanted them run when he invented the political labor camps in the early 1960s. Mm. And so what had happened in North Korea while we were paying attention to somewhere else is that North Korea had a gulag actively going and thriving, and it's still there. That really changed my perception of the place. Mm. And it led to a lot more serious journalism about what the defectors had to say.
Mm. Gulags and concentration camps are not unique to North Korea. What I discovered was unique is that they're family camps, and that the main Kwanli So are political camps. If someone in your family is suspected of a political crime, then you're all cast under this suspicion. And real crime, like stealing a radio, seems fairly rare in terms of being prosecuted there, that most crime is political crime. Your family becomes the unit that transfers terror from the state to the individual because it learns to police itself. Because if anyone makes a mistake, they're all vulnerable. And this way that that just to survive, people have to co-opt the state's terror system was something I had never really thought a human being could cook up.
And that's the thing that your novel does better than I think any book I've read, is the terror of the elderly parents mm-hmm. of the interrogator. He's afraid of his parents, but they're really afraid of him.
Right.
And that's a kind of fear that doesn't exist in any world that I knew
that's right.
before. So how did you get to the point where you could write that about those characters? What I mean, you live in Stanford. You live in...
Yeah, that's true. I've never been tortured, you know, and I've never gone hungry. You know, when I wrote the book, I thought, you know what, I should try to see what hunger is like. Seriously, I mean, I don't know how many of us know it. And so I decided I'm not going to eat for a while. But what I realized really quickly, and what allowed me to eat again, was the discovery that it was totally false, that I had a fridge full of food, that actually I could eat it anytime I wanted, and that there was a psychology I could not recreate in Palo Alto, California, at least for me. But but this notion of what is it to be a human there? I just wondered when I guess I became an obsessive reader, and over the course of a year, I read like 12 books. David Hawk's The Hidden Gulag was very influential to me. You can download it for free as a PDF. It's called The Hidden Gulag. Put it onto your Kindle. It's not light reading.
And it's been updated.
It's a new edition
updated
of it.
Regularly.
When he did it, he'd found 32 human beings who had made it out of a North Korean gulag, out of North Korea, and then out of southern China, which is increasingly the hardest of the three. Yeah. And this is the triple crown of survival, if you ask me. And what struck me when I read that, I got goosebumps thinking of that book. He again matched up the human narratives with the satellite photos and put them together. And, you know, humans annotate, this is where I lived. This was the soy sauce factory. This was the mine head. This is where the executions were. What blew my mind was, I think 8 of those 32 people were guards. They couldn't stand it either, you know, and they couldn't just walk away. They had to do a daring escape as well. And that the system was so inhuman that everyone involved in it loses their humanity, you know, like some type of modern slavery. And so to even be on the safe side of that evil system was to cost your soul, and it was worth risking your life for. So these questions of, I asked this question of myself, if I was a writer born in North Korea, what would I have had to write, you know? And I went and read propaganda. And most important, you know, we both have young kids, and my kids were small at the time. I was like, what would it have been like to be a dad there, you know? And how would I have met my wife? How would we have received our occupations? And the biggest question, and this is the one I'm obsessed with asking defectors about, is like, as they're indoctrinated over the course of their life, there comes to be a point at which they realize it's all a lie. And where is that moment? Is it gradual? Does someone sit you down? And that question of like, would I tell my children that you're not in the greatest nation, that this is a scam, that this is the leader actually hurts us? Because if I told them, it would put them on a quest for meaning, right? It would give them purpose. It would give them insight and understanding, and it could rescue their humanity, but it could cost them their lives.
Yeah, it would probably ruin their lives.
That's the debate I think every North Korean has to face. Like these, in literature and in our movies, we often like the Sophie's Choice, right? But I think if you live in North Korea, these are much more common. I think in your life you have to inform or be informed upon. You have to make decisions over who eats or who doesn't eat if there's a famine. And I think if you follow the rules there, you have a relatively normal life without your identity.
Yeah. And once you leave, you don't really leave. At Hanawon, one of the things they try to do is they give the newcomers a sense of what they were lied to about in the history of the country. And they often tell them, they obviously hadn't read this book, that it was the United States and South Korea that started the war. And in this classroom, when they tell them that, the students, the people from North Korea, stand up and start shouting. They just can't believe that that's not true, that the great leader did not save them from American aggression, because it's one of the fundamental building blocks of their identity mm-hmm. and of the meaning of life in North Korea, that he's protecting them, or his son or his grandson is protecting them from those American bastards who in the 1950s came with their soldiers and their bombs. One of the things I'd like to mention is that the United States has a big role in the creation of North Korea and in the sustenance mm-hmm. of the Kim regime. And it goes back to the way the peninsula was divided. It was divided on a summer night in the White House in 1945 when a couple American colonels decided to draw an arbitrary line across the middle of the Korean Peninsula. And the idea was they knew the Russians were coming as the Japanese were being defeated at the end of World War II. And they wanted to have a way of having a foothold on the Korean Peninsula, an American foothold. They drew this line, and to their great astonishment and relief, Stalin honored it and stopped moving south. But then Kim persuaded Stalin to start the war. When the Americans fought back, they were caught with their pants down when this war began. They didn't have quality troops in the region, but they had a big war machine that they could get going. And a big part of that war machine were the bombers, B-29 bombers, the bombers that had firebombed Tokyo. And they had lots of trained bomber pilots, World War II veterans. And pretty soon, within a matter of months, the Americans were bombing North Korea on a daily basis, and they continued until the end of the war. They bombed every city, every village, and every town, and they very often napalmed every village, city, and town. And Curtis LeMay, who was head of strategic bombing operations for the United States government, he said he estimated that at one point he thinks the Americans killed 20% of the civilians in North Korea. That's a big number. That was about 2 million of 10 million people. If the North Koreans had done to us in the 1950s what we did to them, they would have killed 30 million Americans. So it was a savage bombing campaign. But the genius of Kim Il-sung and his son and his grandson is to use that savage campaign as a way of ensuring their own legitimacy. They say it's tough living in North Korea. This is the current argument. It's, you know, you don't have a lot of electricity. It's food supplies are not great. But we're protecting you from America. They're the biggest, baddest superpower in the world, and it's expensive to have a military and nuclear weapons and long-range missiles that can help provide the kind of robust deterrence that we need to keep you safe from those American bombers who killed your grandma. And it gives that regime a kind of legitimacy that it would not have except for American behavior in the Korean War. And most Americans are completely ignorant of this fact-based narrative. It doesn't make North Korea or the North Korean leaders more acceptable, but it does make them more comprehensible when they threaten to nuke Austin or Southern California, as Kim Jong-il did 3 years ago. There's a method to his madness. He's not actually threatening the United States. He's propping up his own legitimacy.
Mm-hmm. And there have been like campaigns like this in wars 50 or 60 years ago that people have gotten past and gotten to the truth. But this is an ongoing, maintained thing through evacuation drills of Pyongyang and, you know, blackout drills to cover every window for the day the bombers returned.
And fourth graders often use bayonets to run through the bellies of dummies dressed up as American soldiers. AP reported that about 18 months ago.
Yeah, yeah, Chris, Gene Lee. I would also say that I think that bombing taught the North Koreans to be the most prolific tunnelers and bunker builders in the world, And one of the reasons we don't know about them is because they're buried. Because of our bombing, they learned to survive underground. So I think we created that secret second world underneath.
Why do you think that readers respond to such a foreign sense of fear? I mean, the fear in your book is unlike any in the world, but readers respond
thank
to
you.
It. I mean, I felt so afraid for the elderly parents living in the tall building. But why does it resonate in our society?
Yeah, this is an interesting question. Well, first, I mean, to talk about North Korea, there's so much context to kind of maybe understand. I'm not sure there really are experts on North Korea. I mean, if you really are in South Korea and you have access to people, you probably know more than other people. But I think if you dedicate a few years of your life, a lot of what we do know is open source and you can educate yourself. And I feel like I'm not an expert, but a person who's kind of was obsessive and self-educated. In that regard, one piece of context maybe, if the Korean Peninsula looks like this, and again, I'm not Korean. I just was a person who became very interested in the topic, so I'm a student of Korea. If the peninsula is shaped like this, and you know the DMZ is roughly across here, here's North Korea like this. There's Seoul, and there's Pyongyang. The country, we talk about it monolithically, but if you were to meet someone from Manhattan versus someone from West Virginia, and you only met one or two of them, you might have a very different sense of America. There's probably three North Koreas in my sense of it. One is this border region, Mount Baekdu, the Yalu and the Tumen River. If you happen to be born in one of these bordering provinces, then you know border guards, you know people who trade, you know people who cross over and cross back. Your cell phone can hop onto a Chinese tower. You can get these broadcasts. I think in the border region, you're fairly savvy about the world, you know. And then there's Pyongyang down here where all the elites live. It's a parasitic society. And there's a top few percent that are the haves, and they have everything because of the labor of everyone else in the world. And you have to have a high family loyalty rating, your Songbun rating, to live in Pyongyang. And to live in that zone, you know, you have a cell phone and an iPad. More importantly, you have real education instead of indoctrination. They have real universities, real doctors, real hospitals. There's movies and theater that you get to see, albeit propaganda. And, you know, the people there are hip. They get it. They know what the world is. They know what Paris is. You know, they've seen Titanic. They maybe saw it before you. And, of course, there are varying levels in the echelon. You know, when we talk about North Korea as the blank spot on the map, it's these landlocked provinces. And you cannot travel from the place you were born except for maybe your military service. And there's people who are born in these villages and die in these villages to try to defect and move across these other provinces, mountain ranges, rivers. It's a very mountainous country. These are people who don't make it out. And people don't escape from Pyongyang. The number of people who have defected there from there are in the dozens because they have it made. They may be in North Korea, but they are not the peasantry, and they know it. And so they don't bring their stories out, if that makes sense. And there's a lot of normal North Korea whose stories we don't get. One fact that I didn't know for a while writing my book was about these stories I was getting, that here's North Korea. North Hamgyong province is up here. Two-thirds of all defectors come from this single province up by Vladivostok and Chongjin. Two-thirds of all of them. So we think of it as a complete totalitarian society, but it goes from total control to the Wild West as you move out here. The famine hit these ranges the hardest. They have the fewer commodities. They have much less support. And so when the famine hit, these are the people who ran. And it seems to me when people defect, it's only people whose lives are really at risk. People don't up and say, I'm going to leave everything I know and everyone I know and put them all at risk. So the stories we get aren't from normal life, and they're not from an elite life. They're from the people who have the absolute hardest lives. And so I do think our portrait of the North is skewed. And my initial portrait was skewed by people who had it, you know, the hardest. But I set my book in Chongjin because we had the most stories, you know. And so that terror and that suffering and that life and death quandary was most visible. And I think it made my book darker because those are the stories we had. Sorry I got going there.
The numbers of people who've come from the elite are fewer.
Yeah.
I mean, much fewer. But there have been some. There was a book last year called Dear Leader by somebody.
Jang Jin-sung.
Yeah, very, very high-ranking person who actually spent time around Kim Jong-il.
Park Sang-hawk got out. Yeah. He was a bowling champion in Pyongyang.
Yeah, so they come out, but they describe a quality of fear that's not unlike the fear. They have better material circumstances, but they cannot speak their mind.
Right.
They make this pact, and they do what they're told, and they almost never leave, as you say. But the few who do come out, and they talk about fear.
Yeah.
Great.
Well, this is interesting. I mean, if you live up here in North Hamgyong province and you live in Chongjin, well, then Camp 25 is right up here. And the Mantapsan penal mine is right below you. So the psychological fear is the worst fear. Like, you know the camps and you see the trains going to the camps. And the camps are a known fear. If you're in Pyongyang, people disappear. And you don't know what happens to them. You know, I interviewed Kenji Fujimoto, you know, Kim Jong-il's sushi chef. And, you know, in the building he lived in, he noticed that the family next door was gone. You know, and he said, what happened to them? And his wife said, "They will. When one person disappears, they'll be back. When a family's gone, they will never return. And he said, where did they go? And she said, I don't know. And I think that terror of the unknown, you're allowed to feel that yourself. It wouldn't be as bad as Camp 14.
People do know that the camps exist.
Of course.
And the people who disappear, they figure, go to the camps. And the presence of those camps as a tool of control has not diminished under the new leadership. Mm-hmm. There's no indication from the satellite imagery of the camps that the camps are less important. There's new construction in Camp 14. Mm-hmm. There's new construction at some other camps. Some camps have been closed. Some have been consolidated. But new construction, Camp 14, which has traditionally been the place for elite people from Pyongyang to go, that has expanded with a 25% increase in actual territory just in the past 3 years.
Yeah.
So they're very much a vibrant part of keeping the system alive. Fear that if you step in the wrong direction, you and your family could go away.
Well, Blaine's an expert on Camp 14, so he should describe this. You can't think of a prison in a conventional sense. These are the size of small cities.
Yeah.
Camp 14 and 18 straddle the Taedong River. 18 is, you know, a camp that is...
it's been closed.
Yeah. Depending on when you were there, you could come and go. You might have a short term. There were stories of people actually checking into Camp 18 to help send supplies to their families in Camp 14 who were never coming back. But these, like Yodok Camp 15, there's like 50,000 people, and they're there right now. It's morning there. They're just getting up, right, to make military uniforms, to strip timber, you know, all these money-making ventures.
And mine coal.
And mine.
Yeah. And Yodok is one of the few camps where you can go and then leave. Mm-hmm. Although, and generations of people actually did go for sometimes 2 and 10 years. Although, according to David Hawk, no one has been discharged from that camp in the past 4 years now. Mm-hmm. At least and found his way or her way to South Korea.
Mm-hmm.
So it's possible that the camps are even tightening. The revelations of the camp survivors in books and in testimony like David Hawk's Hidden Gulag, they have embarrassed the government. Last year, North Korea launched a big campaign to try to stop a UN referral of North Korea and of the leadership of North Korea to the International Criminal Court for crimes against humanity. And that referral came after an investigation that began in 2013 based on interviews with camp survivors. And the evidence was overwhelming, and North Korea was incredibly concerned that Kim Jong-un would be named by the International Court and found guilty of crimes against humanity. And their campaign has, it continues, and the issue is now before the UN Security Council. The Security Council, for the first time in the history since North Korea came into creation, discussed human rights last fall. And they put off a vote on the referral to the International Criminal Court because it was clear that China and Russia would veto the referral, which would kill it. So they decided not to ask for a vote. But it will come up again this year.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think we could talk forever, and we're going to keep talking and conversing, but I wonder if we couldn't invite some questions to join the discussion. Are there people who... we have microphones. And we can bring the lights up a bit. And, you know, I know you've probably read Escape from Camp 14. The story, Shin's first story, I guess I started working on my book 2004. The story of Shin Dong-hook was very powerful to me. You know, when he first escaped, he tried to tell his story with a comic. You know, I think it was not quite possible for him to put it into words at the time, and that he attempted to try to tell his story with images and forego putting into language what had happened to him. And those comics meant a great deal to me in fashioning my thinking about what was the worst possibility in the worst place, probably. So, questions?
Hello, my name is Crystal. My friends call me Bo. I'm here by chance. My grandfather fought in that war when he was 17. And actually, when he was dying, his memories, he was in peace, but his memories took him back to that war. I'm also a veteran, and my heart started racing when you said that they knew the camps were there. And my question is, they have those similar camps here in the United States. And my question is, are you aware of that?
By camps, Crystal, thank you for your question.
And I tell you it's a camp because the barbed wire faces inward. That's how you know it's a camp that's not a good camp. The barbed wire faces inward. It does not face outward.
Right.
That's how you know that it's a bad thing.
Yeah.
And those camps are here.
So, and you're talking about the American penal system.
Yes? No, I'm talking about the FEMA camps.
Oh, yes.
Those things that are supposed to protect, and they have the triple-decker trains to help take people to those camps, and they also have shackles. Right. Why our government would need shackles, I don't know, but you're talking about this country, and I appreciate the research, but my heart literally, it's just beating my chest right now because I am a veteran, and those camps are here, and I'm wondering if you're aware. And I would love to see
Crystal,
your writing take another...
Yeah, thank you. You know, I lived in Louisiana, like FEMA camps after Hurricane Katrina and Hurricane Rita right afterwards. I did go there to report on that and interview tons of people and visit those camps. Of course, I wrote short stories about it rather than journalism because that's what I do. But I think, you know, something about North Korea... is a little distant from us, seemingly, and is a lens that allows us to look at our own lives. And For one thing, the North Koreans are constant, their narrative is based against us, and they're constantly critiquing us. And when we have a story that's a homeless problem, so there's a story about American hunger or education or healthcare, it's front page news in Pyongyang, you know? And it's, of course, one-sided. But they're fascinated by our prison system. And the two countries can't be compared, let me just say that. But they invite examinations. And 1% of the North Korean population is incarcerated in these camps. Now, of course, there's no justice system. There's no release dates for many of them. It's hard labor where you maybe work to death. But it's an opportunity to think about, you know, why do we have 2% of our country incarcerated? And what is solitary confinement? Is that worse than, you know, a hard labor gang in a mine? Like, which would you pick if you had to pick, you know? So, you know, these are important questions. And whenever someone says North Korea is so weird, I always come back and say, you know, what have we become used to? You know, what have we taken for granted and stopped asking about? So.
Thank you. Thank you very much for a very interesting discussion. How do the North Koreans manage to escape, the ones they do, and what happens if they're caught?
What happened in the 1990s was a severe famine that affected most of North Korea. And it's because the Soviet Union collapsed and free fertilizer and very cheap fuel stopped coming to the country. And there was also some terrible floods. And so there was a severe catastrophic famine, sometimes described as the worst famine in an industrialized country in history. And the estimates of the number of people who died is somewhere between several hundred thousand and 2-3 million people. But it weakened the state. It caused a social collapse, and people started moving around because they were desperately hungry and they're looking for food. So people started crossing the borders. There was not a robust system of defense or of border guards were also starving. So they would take bribes if they were there. And so people did not leave North Korea from the founding of the country, actually from the end of the Korean War until the late 1990s in any numbers at all. I mean, there were a handful. You could count them on two hands. And then they started coming by the thousands. And in the past 15 years, about 28,000 people have come. And it's not like they're across, it's not like the Great Escape. They're coming from northern regions of the country. Many of them are traders. Most of them are women now, and sometimes they come with young children. And they cross legally or quasi-legally by paying bribes, and then they find their way through China because they have some means to escape the Chinese police. So that's what escape is a fairly routine process. I should add that Kim Jong-un came into power about 3 years and 4 months ago. And since that, the border has become significantly less permeable, and the number of defectors coming into China has fallen, and the number who've come to South Korea has been quantified, and it's less than half. So he's really cracked down. It's harder to get out. People are still crossing into China, and one thing that you should understand is that the economy of North Korea is largely that of a scruffy free market system that is in large measure tied to trade across the border with China, much of which is legal. And people often cross back and forth, traders who have papers to do so. Beneath the belligerent rhetoric, there is a system of trade that puts most of the calories in the bellies of North Koreans that they manage to eat now. And the risk of famine in North Korea has significantly declined because the growth of the markets. It's relatively vibrant, and North Korea tolerates it because it's the best way to avoid another famine, and they also tax it. The report based on refugee testimony said that a The security apparatus in North Korea is huge. I mentioned the number 270,000. That was in a recent white paper done. And they are not well paid. So they have to go where the money is. And the money is now in the markets that are in the neighborhoods of every city and town. What they do, according to this report, is they'll go in and identify a trader who has a good business, shoes from China, winter coats, whatever, and they'll take the trader to a nearby field and say, we want 30%. And to make the argument persuasive, according to some eyewitnesses, they'll beat somebody to death in front of that trader to emphasize the importance of the contribution. And that way, the state coexists with an emerging free market system. It's not unlike The Sopranos.
Mm-hmm. I would agree with that. I think that's a very a wise portrait. You know, I would only, you know, add just a couple things. One is that, you know, when Kim Il-sung died and Kim Jong-il took power, there was an immediate famine. You know, within a year it had begun. And that dictated Kim Jong-il's entire course into power, a totally destabilizing event. Kim Jong-un was 12 watching all of that. So when Kim Jong-un came to power, one of the first things he did was allow people to cross into China legally back and forth as much as they wanted for an entire month, as long as at the end they agreed to bring back one metric ton of rice. And so you got to remember, this isn't a place with a rule of law. It's the whim of a dictator. And if he wants to clamp down or he wants to open up, it changes all the time. And so there isn't that stability that we think of as what is a place like. It's however he wants it to be, you know. And also, because there's a repatriation agreement with China, if you do cross the Yalu or Tumen River, you know, they're lower in the summer and frozen in the winter. People who live in those areas know to bribe with cigarettes. But if you do make it to the north and cross, you know, all those people know that if they find you in their field or yard, they can pick up the phone and you go back to your peril. You know, depending on who you are, you know, you're at least going to go to jail, but it could be very severe, your punishment. And so they use that to make you a wife or to human traffic you. And we don't know how many people in China are trafficked because they're slaves there because of this. Humans have to make it all the way to Mongolia or all the way to the Mekong Delta to find the two closest countries who have repatriation agreements with South Korea. And it often takes those people a year or a year and a half of struggle. And, you know, some people don't ever make the journey. So, and we don't have numbers, and we don't get their stories as much.
Mr. Hardin, it's been reported that the subject of your earlier book made up major portions of his story, right, and that was he was actually challenged by other escapees.
Right.
I wonder if you had examined that or examined him, or was the story just too good to not be true?
Right. In January of this year, I found out that Chin had said that he was in Camp 18, which is across the river from Camp 14. He had never told me that before, and he, as far as I knew, he had never said that. And when I found that out, I called him up, and he told me that, yes, part of the story he told me was not true. And within about 6 hours, I got that in the Washington Post and then flew to Seoul to find out what the rest of his story was and how it had changed. And I wrote a new preface for the book, which is now out. Having said that, the fundamentals of his story really haven't changed. Some of the dates and some of the places are different. But he's one of the rare people who actually underestimated what happened to him, or underreported it. There was one, the most severe incident of torture in his life, he was too ashamed to talk about because he was ashamed of the way he responded. And it was when they pulled out the fingernails of each finger on each hand over a period of hours. And that was one of the four tortures he's had. And in the end, it's fair to say that Sheehan is the single most tortured person to come out of the camps of the 60 known people at this point, more than 60. And he also was ashamed of the way he had betrayed his mother and brother, who were executed in front of him. And in my most recent reporting trip, I found a witness to that execution, an eyewitness who watched it and collaborated that it happened. And also North Korea has, in fact, collaborated that it happened. So the changes in his story are rather similar to the changes in the stories of all trauma victims. They scramble the chronology. They have a problem with dates, and they use stories to hide behind them. But as far as I could determine, and with the corroboration I got from my last reporting trip, the fundamentals of his story are true. He was born in Camp 14. He was mostly raised in that camp, and then in a camp, the borders actually shifted from his home village, and it became Camp 18. He didn't go anywhere. The North Korean government changed the borders of the camp. And then he grew up there in a place where people were routinely publicly executed for violating camp rules. And then after he escaped twice, he was taken back to Camp 14 where he was tortured. And the pictures on his that I have of his body and show that his torture was severe in the extreme. A Bowie Bougard, the political police, one of the political police who have escaped to South Korea, said that he was tortured in precisely the way that we torture people in the camps, and that he is the single most tortured individual. So it's not like he became a fantasist of life in North Korea. He simply changed the chronology. And that's where it sits now.
You know, again, like, you know, if the reality of North Korea is a little over here, and maybe we're here, and I don't want to say we're normal or in the center, but it allows us to look back at ourselves. And, you know, when something bad happens to you, I tell my wife, I call my mom. If you get dumped or you have a big setback in life, and when you tell the story, the tears come. It happens for me. To tell a narrative is to begin the operation of a meaning-making machine, right? An experience happens in life, but to tell a story means you must impose structure, chronology, causality, find language, right? You must give voice, right? You must center yourself as the causal location in the chain of events. So in the end, all of these layers of a narrative are going to come up with a multi-layered, powerful answer. And so that's why when we tell a painful story, we feel the pain. And what I've seen, and whether you're interviewing people from Rwanda or East Germany, I spent a lot of time doing that, you know, traumatized people try to do this thing in which they must tell their story. If you don't tell a painful story, it controls you. The only way to take control is to tell it. But then you're giving it the power over you. And imagine if you have a story that's so painful and powerful, it could incapacitate you. And we wonder why veterans never tell their stories. Because they would stop surviving. They would fall apart, at least for a while. And so when I see people telling traumatic stories, they do lots of funny things. To get the catharsis of telling the story and the control without the pain hurting them. Number one, they fragment their stories. They tell them a little bit at a time and take structure away. They change chronology. They tell them out of order. This is a classic thing. And where do you begin a traumatic story? And where does it end, if it ever ends? You know, they remove themselves from the center of it. I interviewed a guy who had defected, and he was talking about, oh, I came up to the river, I was going to cross the river, I was going to do this, and then he did this, and then he did this, and then he did that, and then I got to the other side. And I said, who's he? He looked at me like I was crazy. He said, me. He didn't understand that he had changed point of view to decenter himself from the pain of the crossing, you know? And so imagine the survivor's guilt of the people you leave behind. Imagine the trauma you feel. For me, the weird thing is expecting someone to be able to tell their story in this coherent way. To me, the hallmarks of validity are how the story comes. That's what you can't fake unless you're really savvy about narratives, you know. And the hallmarks of the genuinity of Shin's story is there all the way across it.
And
that's the truth of it.
With Shin, there was one additional factor, is that when he escaped to China for the second time, he actually escaped twice. And at his second escape, he found his way to Shanghai and he found his way to the South Korean consulate. And he stayed there for several months before he was flown to South Korea. And while he was there, he was told that when he got to South Korea, he would have to talk to intelligence officials, police. He would be interrogated. And he had enough time to fashion a story about his life that he felt would allow him to bury the two most painful things, his embarrassing reaction to the fingernail extraction and how he had betrayed his mother and brother, and his actions had caused their death. So he wanted to conceal both of those. And so when he arrived in Korea, in South Korea, in 2006, he had this story down. So he told it to the intelligence officials on his initial interrogation. And I've talked to the Americans who talked to him when he arrived. And he told a long, detailed story that was exactly the same story he told for 10 years. And he carefully hid what he wanted to hide, and he had no intention of unhiding it until the North Koreans found his father, put him in a video, and then aired that video last fall as part of a process of trying to derail the UN investigation of crimes against humanity in North Korea. His father emerged in the video, and what happened was some people who had escaped from Camp 18 recognized the father and said, "I know that guy from Camp 18. And that made it clear that Shin had fudged the fact that he had lived in Camp 14 and then Camp 18. I think to Americans, this is a distinction without a difference, or a difference without a distinction. But in South Korea, it meant a lot. And Shin was panicked and confused and didn't know what to do. And he whispered about it and whispered about it. And I found out about his whispering and then released it to the world and then changed the book.
Thank you for your insight. I'm curious what your diplomatic strategy would be to bring back positive change or healthy relationships between Korea and the United States. And I'm also curious if the strategies between the fiction writer and the nonfiction writer would differ with regards to diplomatic relations. Mm.
Do you have a strategy?
Well, I think the most hopeful way to think about the future of North Korea is that it follows a limited, modified Chinese model and has more industry, which would give more people real jobs that paid real salaries so that they could eat properly. The biggest human rights problem in North Korea is hunger. And if that's resolved, then North Korea could follow the model of China, which is not exactly Jeffersonian democracy, but it's much better in terms of human rights and general quality of life than what they have now. And that seems possible. Kim Jong-un's only been in power for 3 years. He may move in that direction. There is real economic incentive to go in that direction. So that's, I think, the best case scenario for change, sort of economic reform following China and following Chinese investment. Whether that will happen or not, it's just not clear.
Mm-hmm. Here's how bad my idea is. It has to do with sending literature to North Korea, which is not, I'll grant it, a good idea. But there's a lot of reasons that this is the most durable Stalinist regime in the world and why they're still there. But change is happening, and it's coming through technology. Park Sang-hak is floating balloons with DVDs into North Korea. Kang Chol-won is smuggling in thumb drives and DVDs. And North Korea is kind of getting flooded with movies, especially soap operas from South Korea, which are popular with everyone. Go watch them. You know, things like South Korean Wikipedia. Imagine the knowledge of a nation made by its people, editable by its people, and it's not an official version, you know? But one of the things I discovered, and I'm saying this because we're in a room full of book people, in writing my book, was that there isn't literature in North Korea. You know, the Japanese begin their occupation in 1910, you know? And in the colonial period, not only were you not allowed to have Korean names, eventually everyone had to be renamed with Japanese names, not only did they take 800,000 slaves to the mainland to run the factories and comfort women and all that things, but the gayageum became illegal, and the taegeum flute became illegal, and you had to read Japanese literature, and then there was no literature. And so they lost connection with their own stories a century ago. And if you think about the Soviet Union, it's a heterogeneous society with lots of cultures. You could choose to look to the writers of the past, right? You maybe had to do it secretly, for how they handled adversity, you know? You could choose to be a writer at your peril, but the choice existed. Solzhenitsyn wrote in the gulags and got literature out of that experience. And no novel has ever made it out of North Korea. And so in 1910, they lost their own literature. Then there's World War II, then partition by the superpowers, then the Korean War, which is a war our country has come to terms with in no way beyond a TV comedy. And then 60 years of a totalitarian dictatorship in which there's only propaganda. The people that have never read a book as you would know it, and I ask you people who care about books to consider that, having never read a book that questioned society, that shared the human experience, that had a person at the center. And so as they're floating these important things, I wish they would float books in there too. And I talked to Park Sang-hak. He said, they're too heavy. I said, find a way. You know, but it would have an alternative narrative to the official regime. These are things in which individuals are at the center. They're easily to create by people, and they invite questions, and it could connect them to a time before the regime. So I think literature has a place.
I think that's a pretty great way to end tonight's program, thinking about literature and its... In fact, I want to thank both of our wonderful authors here tonight, and I hope you'll join us in the lobby for the book signing. Thank you.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM.